everybody, and welcome to another episode of Books We Pretend to Read. I'm your host, Gunnar, and I'm here with my co-host, Chuck, and with a special guest today, Kevin Goodman. Kevin, you want to introduce, or I can do a big, long introduction for you if you want. It's up to you.
Oh, no, I want to hear yours.
My introduction? So the book we're doing today is called The Hard Thing About Hard Things, and it's a book written from a CEO's point of view to CEOs, and I really needed a CEO's point of view to do this podcast. So Kevin is a CEO multiple times over. According to your LinkedIn, I think it was three times over. Is that accurate or am I inaccurate?
Pretty accurate.
Pretty accurate. Okay. So most recently, Kevin was a CEO of FX Logix, which was sold back in November, I think, to Microsoft, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And he's out of Atlanta, which is where I'm based, although he had to drive an hour to sit in my basement next to the hot water heaters to do a podcast with me. So thank you very much.
I mean,
you say
you're out of Atlanta, but you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
let's be honest.
It's beautiful where I live, man. I love it. Kevin and I were just talking about that. But Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. Your input to this book is going to be super valuable because my history as a CEO, I actually ran my own business for 3 to 4 years. I think when you and I had lunch, we talked about that a little bit, but it's been a while. I'm guessing 15 years ago now that I did that. So my knowledge is also that was a services business, whereas largely this book is about software business, which is your expertise.
Enterprise software businesses they're talking about, and also businesses that can support outside investors, meaning venture-backed businesses or public companies.
And you've done the VC thing. I mean, in this podcast, we are all about entrepreneurship. We've done, the Lean Startup, and I don't think we've done Innovator's Dilemma. I keep going back to that one. We're going to do that one eventually. But we do a lot of we talk about VC, we talk about the stuff, but you've lived it. You've done it.
That's correct. Yeah, it is not easy, especially in Atlanta. The money doesn't flow like it does in Boston or in Silicon Valley, which just means you have to have a really good product idea and surround yourself with really good people.
So when you and I were having lunch, you told me a story about a VC person you were talking to who wasn't aware that you were in Atlanta when you talked to him. Is that for public consumption? Can I share that?
I can tell you that story. I won't say the VC's name or who he's with, but it was a colleague, former colleague of Chuck and I. By way of background, Chuck and I used to work at the same company. Mm-hmm. So did this gentleman. He left and became a VC. I called him. I pitched my idea for FX Logix. He was in traffic on the way to work, and 2 minutes into my pitch, he said, "I'll write you a term sheet for $5 million. Can you be by this afternoon?" And I said, I'm actually in Atlanta. What are you doing there? I live in Atlanta. He goes, never mind. I'm not flying across the country for board meetings. If you want to base it out in Silicon Valley, give me a call. And that was pretty much the end of that phone conversation.
So goes my entrepreneur bug here in Atlanta.
I just killed it. It's dead now.
Now, he did have, obviously, you had success with FX Logix finding VCs here, but obviously, very different story than the VCs that you see out in the Valley. So anyway, I just thought it was a fun story that, he's lived this stuff. I really am looking forward to your point of view as we kind of dig through this book. But this book is very different than any book we've done before. It's not a narrative. In the beginning, he does a little bit of narrative. He kind of gives you his background as a CEO, how he became one, and previous companies. So he worked for Marc Andreessen, correct?
That's correct.
What company was he where he worked at?
That was Netscape.
Netscape.
Okay. Okay. I'm just clicking.
Just to preface some things for the audience, this book was written in 2014, and it's Ben's perspective on his career and back in the day, which is apropos because we're just coming up on 30 years on the internet. But back in the day, he left, I guess it was Silicon Graphics, Chuck, and then went to work for a startup, which was Netscape.
And Netscape, they had to deal with the Microsoft doing IIS, correct?
Exactly. Yep. So if you remember those days, and I lived it, Andreessen was 22 years old, came out of some Midwest college and put a graphical interface in front of a web crawler. And that was the Netscape browser. And they were hugely arrogant. There was plenty written about them in other books. Michael Lewis did one, The New Thing. And the main thing I remember Andreessen saying was Windows was just a partially debugged device driver. in other words, just something to host Netscape. In the world back then, everything was going to be going through the internet. And as you'll see Horowitz's career in the companies that follow Netscape, you'll find out this guy was, he did a lot to shape the world we live in today.
So in early in the story, you're hearing about his background and his connections that he's made. Through those connections, obviously, is how he became the CEO and the man that he is today. But back at that time, you hear the stories of, hey, Microsoft's coming out with IIS, which is the, I don't remember what IIS stands for, but I know it's the web, like the back-end web server.
Internet Information Service.
Back office days. So Microsoft's coming out with this, and they're bundling it inside a Windows server. And their entire business model is off selling this $1,000 plus server and to power the websites of the internet at that point in time. And so Microsoft comes out and they're basically going to do what Microsoft does, undercut the market, bundle, and make a, you know, valuable product. They've done this countless times in their history. And Office 365 is like I think the latest iteration of that.
The difference this time is that they actually were shipping with a better product at the time.
Yeah. It was like six times faster. Wasn't that the number that was quoted over and over?
It was like five times faster or something. Yeah, but it was significantly faster. It was going to be given away for free. And that was a real threat.
So these guys are dead as far as the company's looking. There's no future. They have to figure out in a very short period of time, because they knew it was coming, but not quite out yet. In a short period of time, they had to tackle a monster of technical debt, which is something he talks about in the book over and over and over. This concept of technical debt, which technical debt is just the idea that you can do something well or you can do something quick. And typically when you're on a budget or if you're in a time crunch, you'll do quick, right? So we need to get this new feature out by the end of the quarter or we're not going to get the sale. So you push really hard to get that feature out and you make shortcuts. You don't write very good code. You just kind of cobble it together. Chuck, you can probably speak to this on the engineering side better than I can, but you cobble it together to get it out the door to get the function. But what happens is whatever was cobbled together, it's probably buggy, and the real killer is it probably doesn't scale very well, which means by the then when you need the next feature after that, you realize that, well, everything will fall apart if you don't tackle some of that technical debt.
The architecture you've built is not an architecture that's going to carry you forward. And so at some point, you have to go back and pay that debt, that technical debt, because you know of all those things that you skipped over that were sort of good enough at the time when it just needed to work. And not necessarily, to your point, you know, needed to work, not necessarily be good. Just needed to get the job done. But at some point that comes due, you know, if you are successful and if you get big enough and if you do things, that ultimately comes due.
And that's the key point, isn't it, Chuck? If you are successful.
Right.
There on the other side, you've seen tons of companies that have built in APIs and other stuff for the future, and we can plug in all this other stuff like that, and the product had no relevance in the market, and they probably should have not wasted their time planning for something 5 years down the road, and they probably should check their market better.
Yep.
I need comments like that so you can yell at me. It's like, because I'm on the product, so this is a big thing about the podcast. I'm on the product side, Chuck's the engineering side. So I get to say stuff like, ah, the heck with your technical debt. We need this feature to ship. And then you're supposed to yell at me, Chuck, because you're on the engineering side. That's the way normal business runs, right? Yeah. You get what I'm going at there?
Yeah.
Anyway, so they've got a ton of technical debt at Netscape in their primary product. I think they're only product that's driving revenue for the company. I may be wrong on that, but it's definitely their biggest revenue stream. And basically, they have to, in a very short period of time, sink or swim. He talks in this book about wartime CEOs and versus peacetime CEOs, and this became war. And his company and the engineers, their culture supported that. And they got behind it, they pushed it through, and they still were a successful company after the fact. So they survived. And eventually they sold, did they sell it? To
AOL.
To AOL, thank you.
AOL, yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of the background story of the author. Like, why are we reading this book? What value does this person bring? He then goes on, pretty much the rest of the book, he'll bring back the Netscape experience, but then he'll go on about his first real startup where he's the CEO. And doing this thing from ground up where he took a business and grew it all the way to, I believe, $1.6 billion. Wasn't that the final acquisition cost?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. Well, hold on. So he started LoudCloud.
Okay.
That was first. And LoudCloud was came out of their recognition of, so they're building, and I forget what Netscape's product's name was. I'm not even sure he said it in the book, but the competitor to IIS, right? Mm-hmm. And what they noticed was that people who were hosting this didn't have the networking power or the just computing horsepower to satisfy their own websites. So the idea behind LoudCloud, this is a while back when they did this, was to create their own cloud business. Mm. They're the ones who named it the cloud. Before that, I guess communications people called it the cloud, but they're the ones who named the cloud. Their idea was they'd host the computers for you. Instead of doing a colo like a lot of places were doing back in the time, they were going to host it. They'd have the software on it. And that company, LoudCloud, was the one that they started directly after Netscape.
Really interesting thing about this is I kept wondering, like, when is VMware going to enter the picture here? Because, you know, VMware comes in and kind of takes the model that they were doing, which a lot of orchestration of hardware and all the stuff that you were just talking about. But they were having to do it on hardware, right? And that's where the numbers on it really kind of suck, is really took virtualization to come along to make that really financially viable. So I remember even back in the day, wasn't it called ASPs? They never called it that in the book, but it was an application service provider. It was during the dot-com bubble.
That's
right. I remember
right.
It was called an ASP.
Oh, that brings back memories of the ASP industry consortium. Mm. Yeah, I was in a company that was a founding member of that. But yeah, that's what the idea was. You just get your applications from these vendors.
Which of course, fast forward to 2019 and everything's SaaS. Right. It's, you just get your application. This is software as a service.
Everything as a service.
Yep. Everything. Yeah.
Data center as a service.
Yep. So eventually it came back around to that, but the technology had to catch up, and largely it was virtualization and other technologies that got us there. But they were, you know, before anything. And this, the story that he tells happens during that crisis where all these other companies are going belly up. And he's trying to survive.
Well, yeah, LoudCloud's success was because they emerged right in the boom, and there were all these startups looking for cheap ways to deploy their applications and not have to own the infrastructure. I mean, traditional benefits of quote unquote the cloud, right? And so they were all jumping on, and then the bottom fell out, and so like their entire customer base pretty much dried up.
Yeah. This was post September 11th, 2001.
Yep.
Is when it just got awful.
But they were surviving because they still had one big deal. Was this EDS or am I confusing two different companies? They had like a $20 million contract with EDS. Was that LoudCloud?
Yeah, that was LoudCloud. Okay. So LoudCloud had to deal with EDS, but basically the $20 million you're talking about is when they split the company up and sold LoudCloud. Okay. They sold it to EDS, and what they noticed was that their software for setting up the servers, which turned into opsware. Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Chuck.
I was saying it was the operational portion and the monitoring stuff that they realized still had value outside of running
and provisioning servers and everything else like that. They realized herein lies a CEO's first pivot. You know, he had to go from a hardware company to a software company. And he did it in such a way which he sold the hardware business off to EDS, and then out of the ashes came Opsware, which we've all heard about.
He has this come to Jesus moment where he kind of asks this question. It's like, what would you do if you could kind of do whatever you wanted? What would you do? He says, if I could just take the software and use it as box product type software, get rid of all the overhead of this company and just have this smaller thing, then he would have something he feels he could build from. And that was the pivot that Kevin's talking about, is this a monster change, because it was this company that was valued at, I don't want to say half a billion. I don't remember all the numbers, but it was a lot. And this thing basically brought them down into a penny stock.
Danger of being delisted. Yeah.
And everyone is just saying, well, not everyone, but the employees by and large are just thinking this is a bad idea. In fact, one thing I haven't gone to my notes yet, and I'm skipping in front of some notes. There was a lesson for me, and it's not one I'm too happy to share, but there's a story that he tells that when he's making this decision of this big pivot, these two MBAs come and sit with him in his office and say, you know, give him this 45-minute presentation of what we should be doing and why what the CEO is about to do is completely wrong. And after he sits through this whole meeting, and at the end of it, he says, did I ask for this meeting? Like, that was his only response to these guys. Did I ask to hear this? The answer was no. And this is when he says, this is when it went from a peacetime CEO that's, you know, open door, all this stuff, to wartime. This is the direction we're going. I need everyone behind me or don't be at this company anymore. In fact, he did a company retreat right during this pivot period. And he basically stands up in front of the whole company and says, we're making this big change and it's going to be a hard fight. It's going to be something that we all have to work together. And I need to know if you're with us, you're with us. But if you're not, just let us know now. We'll figure it out. We'll figure severance. We'll help you get a new job. But we don't need people that are going to detract us from our goal with us. And he said only two people took him up on that offer at that time to leave the company right then and there. And he said over the next several years, and I think it was like 4 or 7 years, it was a while, this how long it took them to really get to the point where they ended up selling. Over that period of time, for the remaining employees, which I think was like 80 or so, it wasn't a huge amount of employees, but it was enough. Only two people during that period of time left. So if it was 80, don't quote me on that, but if it was 80, that means 78 of those people remained with them from that pivot all the way to when they sold the company. The name changed from LoudCloud to Opsware. And then Opsware was purchased by HP.
HP.
For $1.6, right?
$1.65 billion, yeah.
Big amount of money.
They were a public company by then, and it was like $14 a share.
Yep.
So I think one of the great takeaways from that story, and something he talked about with the employees in general as a lesson here, one of the hard things about hard things, or one of the lessons you learn, was that the employees, you know, they'll believe in you. They'll stick with you because they believe in the possibilities. They don't actually know how bad things are, right? As a CEO, you do.
Yeah.
And you're looking through this lens, or he was looking through this lens of everything that was wrong, everything that was bad, everything that could go wrong, and how terrible that would all be. And the employees were just looking for guidance in a direction of saying, well, here's what we can do. And they'd be like, great, let's go do that, right? And that lesson of not looking at everything through the lens of, you know, what can go wrong or what will go wrong, but always looking for what can we do? What move can we make next? Like never giving up, never stopping, never, you know, always moving forward.
Yeah. And that was a lesson that really struck home with me because I was saying those two MBAs, I felt like I've been there. To hear this written from the CEO's point of view, I never got the CEO's point of view, but I remember being at odds with my CEO and basically kind of being those people in that meeting. It's like, here's why we shouldn't be doing that, sir. And while I didn't get the same type of reaction that the author gives, the author really points out, it's like, you don't know. You know, I can be this, you know, external analyst guy that's got expertise and whatever, but I'm not sitting in his chair. I don't really know all the other powers that are coming into play that are shaping the decision that he is making. And Kevin, as a CEO, I'm sure you've probably been there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you wanted some insights into that. What I would do, and I would sit there and I would imagine myself in the board meeting when things, they don't always go perfect for you. And I just imagine if I was on the board, what questions would I ask me as CEO? And then I prepared for those questions in case the board asked them. You know, so when they would be there, one of the things he says about being a CEO is you also always have to have uber confidence. And if a board member catches you with a question you're not prepared for and you stammer, I spent my entire career as CEO thinking the very next board meeting is when they find out this guy's a fraud. Let's get rid of him. You know, basically, I always, and I even said this on social media one time. So someone said, oh, you're just looking for compliment. I wasn't that bright. I just surrounded myself with really good people. And I was too stupid to know to quit. And so when I saw Ben Horowitz say something similar in that book, I said, oh, yeah, I can see myself in that. And the other thing is, I would tell you about one of my companies that we were days away from going bankrupt. And if my engineers knew that. And I like to like an engineer's check. Tell me if this is accurate from where your side. I like to liken them to like greenhouse flowers, those really spectacular beings But if you open that door and let a cold winter wind come in, they would wilt like crazy. So I never, no one ever knew that, you know, all of a sudden I just announced, oh yeah, we did some convertible debt, by the way. That I was able to close in time to make payroll. Because if I let all those guys know that, then they couldn't concentrate on doing what their job was, which was to build software.
Yeah.
At one point, he says being a CEO is very lonely because you've got to project that confidence to your employees. So you can't, if you're really struggling with something, something that is on your heart and a real challenge, you can't convey that down the ladder, but also up the ladder. The board is not necessarily there to be your friend.
Always keep that in the mind. The board is not there to be your friends. The board is there, and they have fiduciary responsibility to make sure the company succeeds, right? The corporations have no life of their own. They're only brought to life by the CEO who represents them. And if the board decides the CEO isn't doing a good enough job, then, you know, it's the board's necessity to replace them. And they have the sole responsibility in a company that has outside investors. Typically what they set up is what's called the compensation committee. And that compensation committee does not usually have the CEO as a member of it. And the compensation committee is solely responsible for deciding the compensation of the CEO and who is the CEO. And you notice, even if you're the founder of the company, like I was for two of them, you see written into the articles of incorporation, the CEO has a board seat. Doesn't say the founder has a board seat, it says CEO. So, you know, you are alone and you're worried about some stuff like there. One of the things is, oh my gosh, I put all this time and effort into this company. If they replace me as CEO, they kick me off the board as well. I mean, it's a very, very strong incentive. And the other thing about just regular employees, how many of us as regular employees haven't said at one point in time in their life, I hate this job? Gosh, everybody who changed jobs said that. The CEO can't say that. Wait, it's your company. Mm. You decide what's going on. If you hate it, you're responsible. So there is no way you can ever say, God, I hate this job. If you do, you're in the wrong job.
You hate yourself. And on that, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue to dive deeper into the hard thing about hard things. We'll be right back. All right. Thank you for wading through whatever music I made you listen to. Every podcast, I tend to throw some weird music up there for you guys. So we've given you a little bit of background on this book. But here's the thing. It's not a very linear book. It's a book that jumps around, and if you were to go through the table of contents, you'd see he's really just like creating these nuggets of advice, these stories that happened to him, and here's kind of how you should handle firing somebody or hiring somebody or mentoring somebody. So he's got all these interesting nuggets, and in my notes, I have these different nuggets. And so I want to just kind of intro one of these nuggets, and I want us to talk about it. There was a story that happens in the book where they have this EDS account. It is the entire, like, I think they say 80 or 90% of their entire revenue is this one account, and they're going to lose it. And the salespeople go to meet with them, and their key stakeholder absolutely hates them and says, how much time do we have before you know, pull the plug on us? And he says, 60 days. So they get his entire list of demands of all the things that this guy needs in order for them not to pull the plug on this account. And Ben, our author and CEO, says realizes there's no way in hell that they can meet all these features. So he has what I think is one of the greatest golden nuggets of this book. He decides that there's no way they can hit all these features, and they're not going to. They're going to pick a few, but his golden nugget is, he says, what is the thing that we're not doing? It's not a feature. It's not something he's even thinking about that would make him change his mind about us. And come to find out, he likes this piece of software. I don't remember what it's called. I don't really care. Let's just say some legacy piece of software that this employee, this VP at EDS loves, but his company is forcing him to get rid of the software because it's too expensive. Instead, they're going to force him to go to another piece of software, which they probably get free through, I don't know, their EA with Microsoft. That's how these things typically go. That's not true. I just little side note.
I think a version came free with their competitor software
Yeah. Sounds like EA for Microsoft.
Yeah, exactly.
So this VP is being forced to a different piece of software that he does not want. The CEO does the most genius move in the entire book. He goes and calls this other small vendor, finds out they are really small to the point where it's a small acquisition cost. I think it was $1 million or something.
And he bought them for $10 million.
Yeah. And this is a $20 million contract, right? He ends up acquiring this company simply because he needs this product to keep their EDS contract. So he acquires this other company and he says, we will bundle the software within the contract that you have with us. He turns the VP at EDS completely around. Now this guy loves him because he saved his software and he made it free. And ultimately what he ended up making, the company acquired small, you know, streamlined it. And he ended up making a decent amount of revenue with that other small product. So it's just a really interesting play on a customer saying, you know, you need to have 100 features, which you can't hit. And instead of focusing on 100 features, you're not, obviously not everyone's going to be able to go out and acquire some company to do something like this. But what you can do is that nugget of wisdom, which is, what's the feature they're not asking about that we could deliver on in 60 days? And that, I thought, was one of the most genius things, especially as someone, I'm supposed to be the guy with the product hat in this podcast. I just think that's genius that, you know, there's so many features that we can't hit, but what's the one thing that would change their mind about us? Or what's the one thing that would win us that a deal? Let's go after that. Even if it means a lot of these other features that they absolutely want and need won't happen.
Another small but subtle thing that I noticed that was in there is they were trying to figure out how to get to this guy, and he was pretty standoffish. And they noticed on his flight home, he asked for a long layover. And most people don't even think another thing about it, wouldn't even think to dig in that deep. And it just gives you an indication of the IQ of this guy that he said, something's wrong, we need to find out why. And that's when the guy opened up that he hated his job and he hated his life and he didn't want to go home as fast. And he was actually going to sit in the hotel bar and drink until his next flight came out.
And the crew of that hotel bar knew him by name because this was his common thing.
So they were saying, well, what's wrong at work? That's when the story you just told came out. And I don't think they were ever a thought to dig that out of him. If he didn't just sit there and go, well, that's different, and his brain works in such a way in problem solving that stood out to him.
Just there's so much wisdom in that story of making a customer happy sometimes doesn't mean meeting every one of their needs. Sometimes it means meeting a need they didn't realize that they...
Sometimes it has very little to do with your product.
Yes.
Yeah, so Chuck, you're the product guy, and Gunnar, I mean, you're the engineer, and Gunnar's the product guy. Here's the CEO perspective on this. Half of the hard things he talks about have nothing to do with product or engineering.
Yep.
You know, they're mundane things that come up in just would probably throw you for a loop, and you're going to see him as a CEO in your company. I'm jumping in here, but the thought just came to me. They had to have a whole discussion in their company of profanity versus no profanity.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I thought that was just amazing. Now, like I said, I used to work at Chuck's company and spent a lot of time out in Silicon Valley. And the the F word in that company is an adjective. It's a verb. It's an adverb. And sometimes it's just said instead of the word when you can't think of anything else to say. That's just Silicon Valley, and that's just how that works. But my company, FS Logix, I like to call them the Mormon Mafia. Our engineering staff was all based out of Salt Lake City or just south of there, you know. I got admonished at a board meeting one time, and I didn't even drop an F-bomb. I dropped something way less than that. And they told me that really wasn't appreciated. So tiny little things like that. Is that in any management book? No. Other than Ben's, no, that's not in a management book. Mm-hmm.
It's funny because for about 5-6 years of my life, I did not swear very you know, church going guy. And just
I didn't know you during that period.
No,
apparently,
you did not. and you ruined me. No, this world did though, because where I went, you know, when I was an IT manager, you wouldn't swear when you work in an IT department. That would be unprofessional, and or at least in the world I came from. It wasn't until I really got into the industry, if you will, that it's a non-issue. It's kind of like when I worked for a company called Teradici, and, you know, having beer at lunch was no big deal because they're a Canadian company and they think it's weird as Americans don't just have a beer at lunch. It was no big deal. To me, it was super weird. My wife knew I was hanging out with IT folks or technical guys because I'd come home and my language was worse. And now, of course, my language is horrible. And I blame you, Chuck, and the rest of the industry for making my language awful.
That's good. I mean, I feel like I accomplished something.
Corrupted me, buddy. Corrupted me. All right. So that's one golden nugget. And like I said, the book has a lot of them. And we'll just see how it goes through this thing. By the way, that's page 42, that golden nugget out of about 300 pages in this book. So we're just starting out here. Another one is this story that he tells of, I think it was the company that he acquired. Isn't that where the guy with the cancer
That's right.
came from?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it was.
Yeah.
So that story of whatever that small company was that he acquired for $6 million, there was someone in that company that had cancer and it was terminal. I mean, it was as bad can be. Which means that if he switches healthcare providers at that point in time, it's going to be a, what's it called?
Pre-existing condition.
Thank you. Which means it's not covered, right? Or at least at that time, it wasn't, pre-existings weren't covered. So he was faced with a dilemma in what do you do, right? How do you treat these people? And he says, I really didn't owe this guy anything because it was an acquisition. It wasn't like some guy that's been with him the last 10 years. I don't even think he knew him, but I think it really shows a testament of Ben's character here is he opted to spend $200,000 of his own money to make sure that his insurance was covered. That was the only way he could really see it to be fair because, you know, he's got to treat his employees equally, but he can spend his own money however that he wants to spend it. And so he opted to do that. I don't know if it's a send a signal. I don't know what it was other than it seemed to me just his character that this seemed the right thing to do.
That's how I read it as well. And I tried to imagine myself in a similar position. And although I've not done anything that magnanimous, what happens in these companies is especially the ones in which all 80 of the people you personally hired, the company that... VMware acquired RTO Software. I knew every single employee. I knew their wives' names. Some of them I knew their children's names. And so you get attached in a way that you're probably not supposed to. And later on, he'll talk in the book about when you have to fire people that you're attached to like that. But he did it for whatever reasons he did it for. But could you imagine working in the company that acquired? How loyal you would become to him because he made the end of that guy's life much easier for the man's wife and his family. And I mean, there's no better thing that you accomplish in life than stuff like that.
I think another takeaway from there, and we all know this, some people, maybe people just starting out their careers or whatever may not realize it because you look around and you see like, IT and technology is a vast industry when we all know, three of us, I'm sure, know that it's an incredibly small world. And you will cross and recross paths with the same people under, you know, completely incredible circumstances. And I really do believe, like you say, it's sort of a character play and it's whatever, but like that good karma you put out will come back to you with shocking regularity, cross paths with people you thought you might never see again in this vast sea of technology. And there they are. And I believe that's true in pretty much every industry.
A big world, but small industry. Let's move on to another point. This one's probably a much shorter one, but it really spoke to me. We keep saying, Gunnar, you're the product guy. I'm not a product manager. I just want to make it clear, but I work on the product team. I am in the CTO office at Citrix, and I do product strategy, which this comment in the book cracked me up, and I'm just reading it. And if you guys want to comment, you can. But this is a common question that's brought up is, PMs will say this, how can we walk away from features we know our customers want to focus on things that they might need? And the answer that Ben gives is that's what product strategy is for. And I just loved that comment because I don't do roadmap conversations, right? We have plenty of PMs where I work that do roadmap. They know Horizon 1, Horizon 2, Horizon 3. You know, product strategy is not looking at what is the next feature that we need to have out for a product. It is looking at what is the thing that we need to be looking at well over the horizon where we see this industry going. And I just really like that because it defined product strategy and very succinctly.
All right, my two cents worth on it. And to everyone listening today, if you haven't heard the podcast about the Lean Startup, which is from November of 2018, hit pause, go listen to it, and come back. One of the things they talk there, and there's a discussion whether Henry Ford actually said it or not, is the faster horse, right? Mm-hmm. And the quote that's attributed to him, I think it's been debunked, but it's been attributed to him. They said, if I gave my customers what they wanted, instead of a Model T, I would have come up with a faster horse. All right. And you see that all the time with engineering and product management and product strategy, right? To follow on that Henry Ford line, do you know that Model T line, while it produced so many cars, the reason it was so good and so efficient was they ain't making modifications to it.
They can have any color they want so long as it's black.
Yeah,
right?
That was another thing that supposedly he said. But 5 years later, it was the exact same model. And that's when GM came out with new features and crushed them.
All right. Another little golden nugget. And this is maybe one for you, Kevin, is you can't have a plan B in a startup. Do you have any feelings around that one?
Yeah. You know, here's a good way. If you're going out looking for money and you're a startup and you're an entrepreneur and you're looking for money and you give your pitch to those investors and they go, "Oh, that's pretty cool. What else have you got?" If you say, "Well, I also have this," you're not going to be getting funded. I can promise you right now.
That's a trick question.
You got to have the courage of your conviction to what you're doing. Yes, I know we need to pivot. But that's different from sometimes we need to pivot, and that's, and other than, let's say, Google and Facebook, every company out there is doing something different, perhaps from what they first started doing, right? Microsoft was selling compilers, I think, right? Basic compilers when
Intel
they started.
Intel was doing memory chips.
Yeah, Intel was doing memory chips, exactly. So yeah, at some point you have to evolve and you sometimes have to pivot. But if you've got a plan in place halfway across the river, what's that, axiom about don't change his horses halfway across the river, you got to see that thing through till the end.
Good point. Another good little golden nugget from the book, acquiring companies looking for a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. Just fix your product.
Or as he says in there, lead bullets, normal ammunition is made out of lead, right? So the thing is, stick at it, keep firing away. And I've known engineers, so I came up as an engineer, used to be an engineering manager, and I would see so many engineers looking for a way to perhaps there's a hidden API that I don't know about. I could find some code on the internet that I could just get from one of those GitHubs or what's that, Stack Overflow.
Yeah,
maybe there's something on Stack Overflow would do this for me. And I would go, you know, if you sat down there and coded this, you'd be done already. What are you looking for? Stop that. You know, just go back to work and, you know, stop looking for the silver bullet. And it goes from engineering, but the same is true in product strategy. If we could just find the one game over flaw in our competition, we could exploit that. Or if we could just find that one cool thing in advertising, and this is, you know, what you, at the CEO level, they were looking for it in all areas, that silver bullet. And you have to tell them to stop it and get back to work and plow away. It's harder to do it that way. But that's what you hire those people for.
Well, and it's kind of how he ends the book. Like, the hard thing about hard things is they're hard, right?
Right.
Just, yep. You just need to do the hard stuff.
We had a saying at FS Logics, and most of my guys, I've heard them say it again, so I must have drilled it into them. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it, right? We're a startup mm-hmm. in there because we're either filling a gap or a need that doesn't exist. And if it was easy, someone else had already have done it already. So, you know, the hard thing about hard things is that sometimes you go looking for an easy thing when you should just go ahead and do it.
Next golden nugget. This is the story of the, I think it's the manager that's not meeting with his employees. Your manager, Tim, has not met with any of his employees in the past 6 months. His response to this is like the most cold-hearted shit I've ever heard. Which is, if he doesn't meet with his employees in the next 24 hours, he's going to be fired and you're going to be fired. And it's like, man, that is just ripping my soul out. I mean, I'm not saying he's wrong. Just saying, geez, that is harsh.
Here's my take on that, right? Problems are not like wine. They don't get better with age, right? And if you know there is a problem and you don't act on it immediately, again, you get to that it's lonely at the top stuff, right? I can imagine going into a board meeting and finding out we are having trouble and then finding out that I let management slide. And who are they going to blame? They're going to blame me on that thing. So you can't let those things go on. Now, in his particular thing, he was insistent upon his managers holding one-on-ones with all their employees and found out this guy hadn't done it for 6 months. I took two things away from that. The first one was, even though he had so many employees, his attention to detail, it always amazes me at the guys successful at top who have attention to detail, right? And then the second thing about it that amazed me on that was how quickly he interviewed every one of your employees in 24 hours.
Well, he's making it clear, because the whole point of that story was that you as the CEO, you set the culture. He was trying to make it really clear that teaching employees, making sure that their voice is heard, that this is a critical function of this company. And so if I have a manager who's not even paying attention to his manager, who's not doing his one-on-ones, then obviously they're not hearing me. And so he needed to make it so this was crystal clear that this is important, and that's the way he communicated it. And of course, his response was, do I make myself clear? And he says, crystal.
So I actually want to go back to what Kevin was talking about, which is have an employee who's the proverbial rock star.
Go for it.
Who's abrasive. And I dealt with that. I had, I've told this story in other places at other times, but I had an employee who was like that on a team that I ran, right? I was team lead over a software development project at a previous company. And this guy was an absolute cornerstone of the team. He was reliable. He would solve, you know, any problem you threw at him. He had that attitude of nothing is impossible. He would deliver. He would kill himself to get stuff out, right? Just like an absolute rock. But what he couldn't do is sit in a meeting and hear anyone else's opinion that deviated in any way from what he thought was absolutely correct, without telling them in such a way that it was sort of, no matter how right he was, it was impossible to defend his position, right? Politically, I could never let him win in a meeting because of how he was winning. And so, you know, I had to eat a lot of, eat a lot of humble pie for that. He would get frustrated, but he was such a critical part of the team that it was sort of this necessary evil. And I had to do a lot of relationship building and management around that and set things up. So I'm curious, Kevin, specifically for your thoughts on that, especially dealing with that at potentially higher levels, right? This is one engineer on one team of many at this point. But what is that like when you have someone at a higher level? You know, he talks a lot about executives and vetting executives and how to hire them and how the right person at the right time is so important and needs made change. How do you deal with that situation?
Well, I find I agree with Ben at least about one point, and he talks about talking to John Madden, the former coach of the Raiders, and Phil Jackson, coach of the Bulls back in the day, and asking him how he dealt, because, you know, football and basketball got plenty of superstars. And John Madden said to him, or I think it was Phil Jackson said to him, "You can hold the bus, but only for one guy." Yep. And if you go back and look, he says that one guy was Dennis Rodman on the Bulls. Boy, he was crazy and he was out there, but he pulled down more rebounds than anybody else. And when he got on the court, he was fantastic. Off the court, you might have thought he was from a different planet, but on the court, he was fantastic. And so you dealt with his idiosyncrasies. In software, I've seen it wax and wane. Oh, we're going to have no superstars. Or to a lot of startups, are that superstar decided to go out on his own because, you know, he had opinions and he couldn't get anyone else to listen to him. So he decided to start his own company. You know, investors see that a lot with CEOs. The thing about it is, from my perspective, in the hiring, you got to fit for cultural fit. And this is going to segue into another section in the book where he says type ones and type twos of leadership, right? And if you looked at my co-founder, he was, still is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He didn't work at FSLodge, he works at Microsoft, where he'll do great things there. But he didn't like the limelight. And then, you know, if you know me, you know, I'm not intimidated by anybody. For those that don't know me, I'm 5'5". So if I was intimidated by anybody bigger than me, I'd never go out of the house. Therefore, I'm intimidated by nobody. So no one in a meeting can bully me and ever has. And I've seen, you know, VPs of sales, you know, typically big, tall, handsome guys who are used to getting their way. I just laugh at those guys when they try to make something that is illogical. Now, you have to get the input from your team, but they have to know you're the one in charge of making the decision after you've gotten all the input. I've had guys come to me after I made a decision and say, "Hey, I want to revisit this." And I've said, "You know, what new information do you have to bring me?" "Well, nothing. I just don't think it's fair that..." Well, then, no, sorry. The conversation's over. You know, we're moving on. We're going this direction.
You've made your case. I've heard your case. Yeah. I made my decision.
And we're going this direction with you or without you. You know, that, you know. And in my career, I've changed a lot of lieutenants. Lieutenants come and go. Somebody has to speak for the company, though. So, you know, it always falls on your shoulders as CEO.
So the Rockstar conversation reminds me of something that wasn't mentioned in this book, is the experiment that was done with the different chickens. So if you guys ever heard about this experiment, they took the biggest, baddest chickens that laid the most eggs independently, and they put them all together. And then they took a flock of chickens that, I forgot what it was, they got along very well. They weren't necessarily the rock star chickens, but there were chickens that just got along. Everything was fine. I forgot how long the experiment went on. I don't think it was super long, maybe a month or so. But at the end of the experiment, they took a look to see which set of chickens laid the most eggs. And the rockstar chickens, the big bad chickens, had a couple of them were dead from being killed by the other chickens in there. And overall, their production was pretty low. Whereas the chickens that all got together that were, they weren't the lowest chicken layers of eggs, but they were just kind of mediocre ones, but they all got along. They had well outperformed the rockstar chicken. So when he was talking about the Dennis Rodman and stuff, I often go back to that type of story of when you have the rock stars, especially like the Bulls, right? It wasn't just one. Pippen and Jordan. Yeah. It just always brings me back to that story of, you know, if you're trying to hire a company full of rock stars, they can very easily butt heads with each other because you have really talented people with really strong opinions. I mean, I hope that's what I am, a talented person with a very strong opinion. But, you know, put me in another room with someone with a really strong opinion and, you know, heads often are butted.
Heck each other to death.
Yes, exactly. So there's something to be said about building the type of culture of a good teamwork because none of us can do this thing solo. Right. It has to be. It is always a team effort.
So a couple of things we did that's not in the book that from my CEO perspective. So my co-founder and I we'd come up with a system of, well, how strongly do you feel about that if we disagreed? And you'll find a lot of times you really don't agree, but you're not going to make a stand on this hill for that problem. And where the other guy, you'd be shocked how strongly he feels about it, and vice versa. You know, the other thing you have to remember is it is, yeah, I know we do sprints and we used to do three week long sprints, you know, but the company itself is a marathon. You know, FS Logix went relatively fast, right? In what was it, I guess, 4 years from when we shipped the product to when we were acquired. 4 years is a long time to have, you know, one superstar, you know, burning like a bright candle for the whole time. You know, you got to, and what we likened it to was more like the hot dog station at the 7-Eleven. As the hot dogs roll around, one guy's under the heat lamp, and then he takes a heat, and then he goes off, and then another one takes a heat, and everyone gets their turn as rock star, you know, because if you're hiring correctly, you have a potential team full of rock stars. And I would like to think right now that my co-founders, if they desired, and the rest of my executive team could go out and start a startup right now. Because with the communications we had amongst everybody, I tried to relay them as best as possible all the things that you had to do to get this company going. And engineering might have a quite a bit of different opinion if the engineering manager in the meeting found out what it took to sell the software and vice versa. And those things I think are also reflected in this book when he did a Freaky Friday. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept in there is that not everybody wants to be a rock star all the time. Mm-hmm. You'd be shocked.
Looking for my next golden nugget to go over here. He says this line in the book that spoke to me, and it probably will speak to me if you recall our conversation at lunch, is he asks himself this line of questioning of why do I wake up in the morning? Because he's rich, right? He doesn't need the money that this company is going to bring him. If he wanted to, he could spend the rest of his life on a beach. So why is he, as a CEO, waking up every morning? Why does he come into work? He asked one of his employees, why do you think I come in the morning? Do you think I need the money? Do you think that's why I'm here? And he says, no. He goes, let me explain. I came to work because it's personally very important to me that Opsware be a good company. And that hit me. And I don't know how much more there is to share on the story, other than I know when I've talked to you about my, Kevin, about my entrepreneur ambitions, my primary reason I want to do it is not money, because my company pays me very well. All three of us on this call right now, we're fine financially. The reason I want to be an entrepreneur is because I want to build a culture of a company that I would dream of working at. And like I said, I don't have a ton of supporting conversation around that, other than I just found it really cool to see that that's why he's doing this. It's not because, I mean, ultimately sells the company for $1.6 billion, $1.65 billion. But
what's a half a billion amongst friends? Yeah.
He wants to build the type of company that he wants to work at. And there's something to be said about that. And Kevin, you've actually done it. You know, I can freaking daydream all day long about it, but you've actually done it. You know, what was your motivation?
So I'll tell you, to follow on with your story, of course, I had an idea before we started this company. The reason for doing it and getting it started initially was to make a difference. I think we could make a difference. I think we've got something here. Randy Cook and I had known each other for a long time when we decided to start the company. And we decided that we could make a serious difference, okay? Founded the company, found investors. Those first investors, besides myself, were what we call the FF&F, friends, family, and fools. So we did a seed round with Randy's brother, Brian Madden, a friend of mine in the UK, a high school friend. Okay. So we started our seed round and we gave ourselves a valuation of $5 million. And he said, what makes this company worth $5 million? And I said, this PowerPoint and Randy. That's all we had at the time, right? The second they said yes and wrote the checks, my motivation changed incredibly. Oh my God, I got outside investors. I have to get them a return on their investment. Okay, I have to get them a return on their investment. And it's something you can never lose sight of after that. You have to get them a return on investment. You work for public companies, that return on investment shows up quarterly now, right? But it's never out of the CEO's mind. What can I do to, and it goes a couple in companies such as the ones you work for, you have responsibilities to your shareholders, to your employees, but you also have responsibilities to the legacy of the company. Gunnar, your company's been around 30 years, probably close to 20 now for yours, Chuck.
Yeah.
That's 20 years. Imagine being the CEO and running it into the ground. Oh gosh. Not only, these are the things that go through your mind. Not only would I have destroyed the shareholder value for all of these people, but then I got, if I ever looked the founders in the eyes, those that are still surviving and stuff like that, said, oh, I took your baby and killed it. You know, those types of pressures, they are in the back of your mind all of the time. I have to get these people a return on their investment.
Ben talks about how he couldn't quit. Like, as a CEO, you can't quit because exactly what you're talking about. It's like those founding investors, friends, family, and fools. Those family part of it, I think, wasn't his CTO's brother also, or some family member of a founder that he had was one of their investors as well. So not only I can't quit because these people gave me their money, these people are family or friends or fools, as you said, but I can't quit. And so that's the other kind of almost a warning as potential entrepreneurs. When you go get that money, understand that. How are you going to look at these people in the eyes ever again if you quit on the very investment that they put into you?
You'd have to do something other than work in that industry too. Where are you going to get another job?
Yeah.
If you gave up, let's say, now there are lots of CEOs who tried and failed. Not every company is successful. What does Ben say in the book? 22%. You know, if you batted 220 in baseball, you wouldn't be in the majors very long, but 22% is highly successful. What did we always hear about the VC? And Ben's running a VC company now. The 1 out of 10 hits a home run, and you're doing well as a VC firm. But so going and giving it your all and not succeeding is a lot different than giving up, and that is the part that I believe when he was, why do you get up in the morning every day? God, you're extremely motivated. You would sit there and you would close your eyes when times are going bad and imagine the conversation you're going to have with your co-founder's brother that the $250K you put in that you told me you really didn't have. I lost it. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Why'd you lose it? Because I just don't give a shit anymore. I can't do it anymore. Jeez. Oh my God, no. Yeah, to try to get a job ever again, put that on your LinkedIn page.
All right. Oh my gosh.
Or as Ben says, if I may, what is it? WIFIO.
Yes.
He gives an acronym in the book. It's we're f***ed. I'm out.
Yeah, it's over, I think.
That's
going to happen at least 3 to 4 times at any point or more. And
you can use the F-bomb. I just put a quack over it.
Oh, thanks. Sorry about that. Post. I thought I was back working for VMware.
my only company, unless I count lemonade stands, it was all bootstrapped. So the VC just scares the crap out of me. This is completely outside of the story, but I was at an angel meeting in Athens that actually the Lean Startup Jim, the guy that was on Lean Startup podcast with us, he is the one that set this whole meeting up. And so there's all these angels investors going up there and chatting. And one of these guys comes up there and says, I give $250,000 investment into a company, but then I make them put me on as a paid member on the board at $25,000, and I own something like 60-80% of their company. And it's like, this guy, like, worst person in the world to take money from. It just blew my mind that people like that are out there. But people are out there that take the money.
Tank? Have you ever watched that show?
Shark Tank. People tell me I should watch that show.
If I may, my take on Shark Tank, okay, which is nothing but theater. I have never, ever, not been able to get a meeting with the VC, and B, none of them have ever told me my idea was not worth investing. They all say the same thing. That's really good, and I'm rooting for you, but you're a little early for us, so why don't you get some more traction, and we'll come back around, and maybe we'll actually partake in the next round, all right? And the reason for that is, who wants to be the guy that turned down Zuckerberg because you just didn't think his Facebook dating site was ever going to work, and insult him in the process so that when he's going for his B round, he excludes you? That is their absolute no-no for them. They would never do that. No one ever insults you. And the other thing that they say is they don't know what a good deal is until they look at all deals. And they have people at work in their companies, all of them do, called, I think the name changes, but most of them call them sourcers, that go out and source deals. It's the fresh-faced Ivy League kid straight out of school whose job is to go through the internet, comb it, and find a new company. I would get calls from these guys all the time, and this is for later rounds. But on the seed investors, I went and talked to all those same angels you talked to, and yeah, it's funny. I had one that wanted to give me $100,000. He was going to give me for 10% of the company, but the $100,000 would be $30,000 in cash and $70,000 in office space in his building, in which he had been oversold by his VC. I mean, excuse me, by his real estate agent. So basically, it was a quote, and I'm doing air quotes now, everyone. Incubator. So you go into their incubator, and there's where you're paying rent, and he's paying you a 30K salary. Yeah, okay, for 10%. Yeah.
Well, isn't that Silicon Valley? The HBO show, isn't that what's his name? The annoying guy. I know his real name is TJ something. But anyway,
Urlacher.
Urlacher, yeah. Isn't that his Urlacher. Whole thing? Like, yeah, that's you his. You stay in my house, and I get 10% of your company.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take another quick break. And you know what, Chuck? We might just wrap the podcast up here and make this thing a two-part podcast. What do you think? Because we got a lot more to talk about.
Yeah, that might work.
So yeah, I'm going to wrap this thing up as if it's the end of this podcast, which means stay tuned, because in 2 weeks or so, we'll be posting the second half of this conversation, because there is a ton more to go over in this book. But we're already at an hour here, so look forward to that podcast. If not, I'll probably edit this out anyway, so it doesn't matter. So thanks for joining us, and have a good one.